A big week for the pro-life movement. Every year this week is a big week for the pro-life movement, which has increasingly become the movement for basic sanity. We talked a little bit last hour about the happenings in New York this week, but lots of good reason for hope as well. But we would love to have conversations with folks who maybe are on the fence about the pro-life arguments or maybe have decided that they are pro-choice people. You are welcome to call. It's an open forum for Pro-Life Month here and for pro-life week, and we have a wonderful guest to take your calls and engage in those conversations. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, and we really do like conversation here, so do not hesitate to call. We're not going to put you off just because you disagree with us or something like that. Our guest is Stephanie Gray, who has given hundreds of pro-life presentations across North America and in the UK and Ireland, Austria, Latvia, Guatemala, Costa Rica, and hundreds of media interviews in defense of life. She's the author of Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth, as well as a book called A Physician's Guide to Discussing Abortion. She lives in Vancouver, Canada, but you can find her at loveunleasheslife.com. Stephanie Gray, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me back, Si.
And so did you make it to any walks or anything this year, or what were your events like?
I was actually just at the March for Life in Washington, D.C., and 2 weeks before that, I was at Focus's SEEK 2019 conference in Indianapolis. So there's been a lot of activity in just a few short weeks of 2019.
I hope you saw some of the same people at both, because those SEEK people are wonderful, and we need them out
there.
They
are. Yeah. It was my first experience, and the mass, where there are hundreds of priests processing, honestly felt like heaven on earth. I mean, the mass always is heaven on earth, but it's like, this is what heaven will be like, the communion of saints going forward to the wedding feast of the Lamb. It was really moving. I almost was moved to tears at the first mass. It was beautiful.
How beautiful. Now you have, something I wanted to ask you about, because you have written about all kinds of pro-life and life ethics type questions. But you have written kind of an extended apology for about in vitro fertilization. And you've also written a shorter version of that as an article. I think it was for did you say – was it Reason? No, The Federalist.
The Federalist. Yeah. Correct. Yes. Right. An apologetic. Of course, when people hear the word apologetics, they think, are you apologizing? So it wasn't an apology for our position on IVF, but it was an apologetic explaining why IVF is not the ethical approach to take, even though the desire to have children is a good and God-ordained desire within our nature. And you know, the topic of IVF came in the news recently because Michelle Obama, when she wrote her memoir, Becoming, she wrote about how she and Barack actually struggled with infertility, and they conceived their two daughters, Sasha and Malia, via IVF, which people, for the most part, didn't know until her memoir came out. And so the Federalist asked me to write a piece in which I explained that as good as the children are that were conceived by IVF, just as a child conceived through sexual intimacy but outside of marriage is nonetheless still a good, the means through which those children come into existence, whether it's sex outside of marriage or whether it's IVF, is just two examples. That means isn't ethical, even though the end result is a beautiful and good thing, a human person. And the reason that we ought – go ahead. Were you going to say something?
No. Please continue.
Well, I was going to say, you know, there are several reasons why I think we can explain to people IVF ought to be rejected. One of the reasons is that human beings are killed to create human beings. So countless individuals are in freezers or have been destroyed in an effort to create embryos. So maybe where couples may have one, two, or three children as a result of IVF that are brought to term, do they have 5, 10, 15, or 20 children that are frozen somewhere that were created but not implanted, and so forth? The other problem is it treats human beings as objects rather than subjects. There's this mentality that I can just put parts together and I can can create a human the way I would create a car, you know, on an assembly line. But because humans are objects and not subjects, we shouldn't come into existence the way objects do. There shouldn't just be someone constructing parts.
We just got our words flipped there for a second. Human beings are subjects and not objects. And so we shouldn't come
Thank you for correcting me. Yeah. Thank you for correcting me. Yes. So because we are subjects, we shouldn't be brought into existence the way objects are brought into existence, which would be a manufacturing, a making. We should be begotten. We should be the fruit of love, sexual intimacy, in which the human person, while the man and woman can create an optimal set of circumstances to try to conceive that human person, knowing, for example, the woman's fertility, timing their sexual intimacy around that, at the end of the day, they don't know which sperm is going to find the egg and fertilize it. They don't know precisely which month that will happen in which whatever egg is released that month. But when you do IVF, you're manufacturing, you're making, and the human person therefore doesn't come to be in the body of the mother below her heart, but comes to be in a petri dish. The first encounter with another human person is not the parent, it's with a scientist. The child's life is in jeopardy, you know, being placed in potentially a freezer temporarily. And so there's so much that is done to the child or that jeopardizes the child, that as good as the child is, we should not use that means to create the individual.
I think there'll be a lot of people who object because there's basically their idea is that it's only an injustice if the person knows it's an injustice. And this little – these, you know, the sperm and egg meeting this little one-celled creature, it doesn't really have any rights because it doesn't have any clue what's going on.
You know, if someone were to say that, I would make the point that even a newborn child isn't going to know what's going on around him or her in a way that we know what's going on. And yet we don't mistreat a newborn child. So, of course, the one-celled embryo, the preborn child after that, but still early in pregnancy, doesn't have an awareness. But the morality of an action is not grounded in whether the individual who the action is being acted upon is aware or not at the time the action is occurring.
Right.
You have to look at the nature of the action itself.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I guess we see that truth in that horrible story we just had about the comatose woman who gave birth. That clearly a great injustice was done to her, whether she's aware of that or not. It is a great injustice.
Correct.
Fair enough. Our number 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Stephanie Gray, author of Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating, is our guest this hour. And if you, whether you are pro-life or pro-choice, we'd love to take your call with anything having to do with the pro-life agenda. You also talk about the end of life, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and all those kinds of things, as well as your talks on abortion.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm going to Texas on Friday, where I will be speaking in Austin at Boots on the Ground, which is a youth conference. And I'll be specifically giving a one-hour pro-life apologetic session on the topic of assisted suicide, which is a growing problem in both your country and mine and around the world, and really equipping people to be able to speak more winsomely and persuasively on a topic in which increasing numbers of people are thinking it's totally acceptable to just end your life if you don't want to keep living.
888-318-7884, that number. Let's go to Frank. We'll start there with Frank in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on the EWTN app. Frank, your question for Stephanie Gray.
Hi, good evening. I don't know how to ask, but I think it's just basically I'm pro-choice, but the rest of my family doesn't like the fact that I vote with Donald Trump. I mean, they look at all this terrible stuff that he's done, but they don't look at the wonderful thing of, you know, pro-life. And so I get accused of being against my own ethnicity of being Hispanic because of the wall and the DACA situation, all the immigration situation. So I'm like, you know, I mean, I know what they're talking about, all the terrible things that Trump does. But I guess they don't understand that it's not that I'm debunking everything and excusing everything that he does, but I'm telling them, if you're not born and you don't have life and you don't get raised to make it to 18 so you can vote, then how can you change the world if you don't have any life, if somebody yanks you from your mother's womb? I mean,
are you?
But I don't, I've explained that to them, but I don't know what else to say to them.
Fair enough. Let's say, you know, Frank, I want to ask Stephanie then, because it does seem, that seemed what you were asking is, what else is there to say to family members who say those kinds of things?
Yes, well, I think you've made a good point already, which is that the right to life is the most fundamental. And any other right or desire that we have, a right to freedom, a right to vote, cannot be acted upon if we have no life with which to exercise these other things. So you've made a very good point that that's the most foundational of rights. I think when people raise, you know, the issue of a politician supporting bad things as well as good things, is I would just focus on one issue at a time. And I would say, let's set aside the person for a moment, and let's just look at the topic, the issue of abortion, and then engage your family members on that. Do they acknowledge and accept, as science has established, that life begins at fertilization? If they don't, when would they say life begins, and begin a discussion with them about that? I think another point we can make is the test of any civil society is how it treats the most vulnerable. And so the question we have to ask is, who of our society is the most vulnerable? Well, that would be anyone who cannot speak for themselves, defend themselves, run away if they're in danger. And that would preborn children, rather, would fall into that category. They cannot speak for themselves. They cannot run away if an abortionist's instruments are coming towards them. And so they are the most vulnerable, which means a civil society will protect the most vulnerable, not harm the most vulnerable. And so if we see these vulnerable children who are weak and dependent, we have a responsibility to care for them, unless someone doesn't think they're children, which is why the debate needs to be had, not about who the politician is and other issues that individual will hold, but when does life begin and how ought we treat our fellow human beings, particularly children?
Frank, we got to go to a break, but if you'll hang on, I'll ask assistant producer Marie to get your address and we'll send you a copy of Trent Horn, his book, Persuasive Pro-Life, which may be helpful to you. Again, the number 888-318-7884. It's a pro-life open forum today. We have our very fine guest, Stephanie Gray, here with us. You can find out all about Stephanie at loveunleasheslife.com. 888-318-7884 is the number. You can still get your free Kindle copy of Trent's other book, Made This Way, that he wrote with Layla Miller. Just go to Amazon.com and you go to Made This Way. You search Made This Way, and then you go to the Kindle page, because we're giving away the Kindle edition, the electronic edition, the digital edition of Trent's book, Made This Way. 4,000 downloads thus far. Go get yours at Amazon.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just try to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popcheck thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest, Stephanie Gray, is one of the preeminent defenders of life in all its stages, both in North America and around the world. And I say North America because she lives in that country to the north of us, Canada, in the Vancouver area. Did I pronounce that wrong? I sometimes get that wrong.
Well, you know.
Yeah. By the way, I always like to ask you, because you know all about this. It seems to me that Canada is always on these, especially the end of life issues, one step further down the slope than the United States is. And is it?
We are.
Is that the case?
We are. Unfortunately, it seems to be more of a, you know, liberal, I don't even think the word liberal really captures it, but morally loose, you could say, society. And then I would say even one step further down the slope would be the UK. I would say they're even worse, unfortunately. But yes, we have a lot of challenges in Canada, particularly as it relates to assisted suicides, recent legalization on a very broad level, whereas you only have it legal in just a handful of states right now.
Right. So it's nationwide in Canada, where here it's mm-hmm. a state by state. Having to do with a Supreme Court decision, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago in Seattle, it was brought from folks in Seattle. But our Supreme Court for once had the sense to say, no, we're not going to nationalize the issue. But it's dangerous. Why? Why do you say to people, you should say no to assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Well, because a civil society does not kill its weakest and most vulnerable members. And those who are sick, those who are disabled, those who are near death are very weak and vulnerable. There are, you know, emotions, inclinations, pain that can skew the decisions that we make. And we need those around us who have a more objective view to help us see clearly when we feel that we can't. And just giving in to, you know, in a moment of weakness, someone's desire for assistance with a sooner death rather than the natural death is not really helping that person when they're at their weakest and they're most vulnerable. And I think it puts other people in jeopardy who would never want assisted suicide, but may say in a moment of great pain, I just want to die, and suddenly find themselves be taken seriously and right. have, you know, the quote unquote medical professionals come in and start to, you know, write down notes and do a little interview to see if that they are candidates for assisted suicide, when all they meant was, I am in so much pain. This is the degree of anguish and agony that I feel.
Right.
Help me. And when help me turns into kill me, then who is safe?
If you find yourself a defender of assisted suicide or euthanasia or abortion, we'd love to hear from you as well this hour. Our number, 888-318-7884. As a matter of fact, I'd like to go far enough to say, if you'd like to defend a pro-choice position, whether at the beginning of life or the end of life, if you'd like to defend suicide or euthanasia or abortion, we'll send you right to the top of the line, because we would love to have that conversation with you. 888-318-7884. We're going out to Gary. I don't have a location for you, Gary, but you are up next. Your question for Dr. Stephanie Gray.
I'm
not a doctor, but
I did it again. I think I did that last time you were on as well. I promoted you to doctor. I apologize. I don't know if I promoted or demoted you, but I did it again. Gary, your question for Stephanie.
Thank you. That's Gary from Missouri. And what I'd like to do is just pose to you both, because I realize that you understand this, but I'm over 65 years old, and I can say, and I was adopted, and I've talked to my original blood mother, the one who birthed me, and I also lived with my parents that adopted me. And I just want to say that I'm thankful for those women that make the choice to not destroy life, because had I been destroyed, I would not have had the opportunity to be blessed by the things that I was blessed throughout my life. And also, from now that I have my grandchildren, I unfortunately had a daughter who had a baby outside of marriage, and I am just tickled pink that she chose to choose life and keep this grandson, because he is nothing more than a beautiful diamond in my life. So I just wanted to offer that opinion and throw it out that us adopted children, thanks be to God, there are people out there who say, we want life, and we want to share, even though we can't maybe keep our child, we want that child to go to someone or to be loved by someone and carry out their life to the fullest. So that's what I just wanted to say.
And thanks, Gary.
Thank you both for your program.
Oh, thank you, Gary. Thanks very much. Stephanie.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. I think it's so important that adoption be something that is promoted more and stories like yours be something that is shared to give the adoptive mother hope that in placing her child into the arms of another person, a couple, a family, that that child can be raised well and that child can go on to lead a beautiful life and create more life through children and grandchildren. And I think adoption, however, is often resisted by society and by individuals because it's perhaps the most difficult of all the choices in the moment. Because with abortion, what happens is the woman in crisis is thinking, I'm going to get rid of this pregnancy for the most part in the first trimester before I feel this baby kick, before I bond with this baby, before I connect with this baby. So I will be eliminating someone I have no bond with. Adoption is very different. Adoption says, I'm going to carry through the rest of this pregnancy, which means at some point over these 9 months, I'm going to feel this baby kick. I'm going to bond with this baby. I'm going to go through painful labor for this baby. I'm going to hold and see this baby and therefore want to keep this child. And then I'm going to make the decision to place this child in the arms of someone else. And in the short term, that is a painful choice to make. That is a difficult choice to make, but it's the choice of love because as St. Thomas Aquinas says, to love is to will the other's good. And so that birth mom who places her child for adoption is doing so because she wills her child's good. And in her circumstances, perhaps is discerned that the best good she can provide for her child is an adoptive family. That might not be the case for another woman in crisis. She might find that in her situation, she can provide all that the child needs by parenting the child. But for the woman who discerns the best thing she can give her child is a loving adoptive home, she needs to be encouraged to know that there are beautiful adoptive homes out there and that there are many options to choose open adoption, where that woman can stay in contact with the adoptive family, with her biological child, to know how the child is doing so that she can still stay connected to the child that she understandably has bonded with and deeply loves.
888-318-7884, the number. Stephanie Gray, our guest this hour. It's interesting, as you were speaking, I was thinking, Stephanie, that every child now, given the conditions in our country, the mother made a positive choice. So for a mother to give up a child for adoption, that already is a message that child, they're going to reason it out at some point, that she didn't have to do that, that she did that for them.
Right. That she was thinking of them good. And their well-being. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Let us go to, where am I going right now? Let us go to Karen in North Carolina, listening on Sirius XM satellite channel 130. Karen, your question for Stephanie Gray.
Hi, Stephanie. You know, right now our family, my husband and I are very pro-life to natural death. But his brother, who is an attorney now and retired, is spending all his time pushing forward assisted suicide and making it legal, accessible in North Carolina. And it's kind of making every Christmas, Thanksgiving very awkward because he tries to bring it up and he just thinks it's just okay. And being raised Catholic, I'm Catholic, all the families have been Catholic, we just don't know where this came from, and we don't know how to even approach the subject with him to rethink this.
Yep. So would you broach us that?
So a few thoughts come to mind. The first is, especially when you talk about his background, you know, being raised Catholic, but now he is on a mission, he is determined, is I always think, what is underneath that passion? Does he have some connection to someone who has suffered extensively and this is almost a reaction to observing and entering into that suffering even, and he's misguided in his solution, but perhaps that's influencing him. So whenever the emotions get involved, whenever a personal connection gets involved, that's significant and we want to discover that. So I would have a lot of curiosity. Where does your passion come from? When did you first begin to care about this issue? When did you first hold this position? And did you used to reject assisted suicide? When did it change? Why did it change? All of those answers are going to shed light on the issue. The other thing is I would tell him in all genuineness, you want to read the best argument he has for why euthanasia and assisted suicide should be made legal. And would he be willing to provide you that in a book, a blog, whatever the case may be? Then hopefully your receptivity to hearing his argument will allow you to say, and in fairness, if I give you my best out there that I think makes the case why it should be rejected, would you be willing to read that? And then can we have a discussion after each of us has read the alternative perspective? A book that I highly recommend is one written by a former colleague of mine, Jonathan Van Maren, in partnership with another author and friend of mine, Blaise Elaine. It's about discussing assisted suicide, and I've written a review of it on my blog. So if you go to loveunleashslife.com and go to the blog, it's probably in one of the most recent 10 blogs that I've written, and you can read all about the book and where to order it. There's also extensive reflections on my website on the topic of assisted suicide and euthanasia. And one of the philosophies that I rely heavily on when addressing this topic is the insights of psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Dr. Viktor Frankl. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences of suffering in the concentration camps and his theories in psychiatry and psychology. So I can elaborate that on that a little more after the break, because I think I'm hearing music.
Yep, fair enough. Karen, if you can hang on, that would be great through the break. 888-318-7884, our number. If you happen to be a pro-choice person, whether it's at the beginning of life or the end, or if it's for in vitro fertilization, you go to the top of the line. 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it is outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception, using scripture, papal and magisterial teaching, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent put forward a compelling case for Catholic teaching with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging onto the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Tom Price.
And I'm Gloria Purvis. Tomorrow, we'll bring you all the Catholic news of the day, along with interviews with newsmakers and our godly council.
Please join us for Morning Glory, 7 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Gloria didn't say my name. I hate it when Gloria throws it back to us and she doesn't say hi to me. But whatever, that's all right. She's a big, important star. I understand. 888-318-7884 is the number. Our guest, Stephanie Gray, and we were speaking with Karen in North Carolina about assisted suicide when we went to the break, and you were sharing about Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes, thank you. And one of the things in his book that he speaks about is that in the face of suffering, what determines whether we despair or not is whether we find meaning. He even has come up with a mathematical equation to express this point. He says D equals S minus M. Despair is suffering without meaning. The point being that despair is what will ultimately lead someone to suicide. And he says that the S in that equation, suffering, cannot be eliminated from the human experience. That is a part of our lives. And so whether or not we despair in light of suffering is whether or not we find meaning in the situation that we're in. And Dr. Frankl made it his life's purpose, not only in the concentration camps when he was suffering, but afterwards when he became or continued with his psychiatry, he made it his life's purpose to help people find meaning in their suffering so that they never did despair. And he cites an example of a teenager in Texas who was a quadriplegic as a result of a car accident. And he said, "Let me tell you how she spends her days. She watches the news, and anytime she comes across a story of someone who is suffering in some way, going through a difficult time, she asks for an assistant to bring her a little stick and place the stick in her mouth. And she then uses the stick to pound out keys on a keyboard in order to write notes of encouragement to the suffering soul she watched about in the news." And Dr. Frankl said that young woman lives a life of profound meaning. She's not despairing even though she's suffering because she's found meaning. And so, Karen, what I would say ultimately is the main point I think we need to get across to people who support assisted suicide is we need to help people find meaning in the situation that they're in. And even when the situation is as profoundly agonizing as someone becoming a quadriplegic, as that teenager did, it's even in that situation that she is uniquely positioned to motivate and inspire other suffering souls in a way I couldn't, precisely because of the suffering that she herself faced. So the key is to help people find meaning. And that's certainly one perspective to hold. But if you go to loveunleasheslife.com, you can read a lot of my reflections on assisted suicide and find that blog advertising the book on discussing assisted suicide by my friends Jonathan Van Maren and Blaise Allain.
Karen, thank you very, very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is our number. It just seems obvious that if suicide becomes just one option among others, or if euthanasia does, we're not going to do as good a job of figuring out how to help, first of all, alleviate the suffering to the degree that we can, and second of all, help people find meaning at the end of their life.
Absolutely. When people are in pain, our immediate reaction is to want to alleviate their pain. So we have to get creative about where are the pain meds, or they don't even exist. Well, then let's get scientists to develop better pain meds.
Right.
But if we start killing the people who are in pain, then we lose the motivation to come up with cures, to come up with better, you know, interventions and so forth. So it's a very big problem with consequences people aren't realizing.
Let's go to Tim in Indiana. You are up next. Tim, your question for Stephanie Gray.
Yeah, guns are essentially used to kill, in effect carry out the death penalty. Why would any Catholic think it prudent to own a gun, thus like wishing the death penalty on someone?
Could you maybe elaborate a little more on what you mean? Would you agree, for example, that a gun could be used if someone is starving, a gun could be used to kill a deer and provide food for a hungry family?
Yes, I'm speaking more in the sense of like handguns or guns that a person uses for self-defense. I'm not really speaking in terms of hunting guns or hunting.
I just want to ask real quick, is your sense, Tim, or your position that we're not really pro-life if we're advocating for guns or if we want people to have guns or that kind of thing?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, fair enough, Tim. Stephanie.
So, I certainly think that the perspective that we should hold is that it is always wrong to directly and intentionally kill an innocent human being. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Tim, okay. And then I think another perspective I think we could probably agree on is that when someone is committing an act of aggression, we should only use the amount of force necessary to stop that aggression. So, for example, if a teenage boy is beating up a five-year-old boy, would you agree we should absolutely intervene and we should stop the act of aggression? But would you agree that pulling out a gun and just shooting the teenager when you could jump right in and separate them, pulling out the gun would be using more force than necessary to stop the act of aggression?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So I guess the question then becomes, if we can agree on those principles, is it possible that there are some acts of aggression that when they are being committed, the only way to stop them would be force that requires the use of a gun? And an example would be a police officer comes upon a situation. Do we think that the police officer ought to be equipped with a gun so that if the only force able to stop the aggression he encounters is a gun, that he ought to have the gun accessible and use it? Would you agree with that?
No.
Oh, so do you think police officers should not be armed with guns?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's a position I've just not heard. Would you acknowledge that that's a position that most people wouldn't hold, that most individuals believe police officers who are called to protect the vulnerable should have a weapon on them that, if needed, could protect the vulnerable?
I believe that most people think that and believe that. However, I'm kind of leaning to the idea that no one should have guns, because a gun is effectively a death penalty, and basically Catholics are not for the death penalty except for in extremely, extremely rare cases.
Right. I mean, the general principle, again, is that the death penalty would only be appropriate in circumstances in which the only way to prevent someone from being a threat to society is by means of the death penalty. And that's why in practice, you know, we can keep people in prison and prevent them from being a threat to society, which would make the death penalty, my position would be something that we do not act upon. I think fundamentally, though, the point that we need to get across is all human beings are made in the image of God. All human beings are valuable, unrepeatable, and irreplaceable. And we ought to respect and protect our fellow human beings. When someone becomes an aggressor and is going to attack another human being, we don't look at them, if we intervene with a knife, with a gun, with a taser, with our own hands, whatever method we use to stop the aggressor from committing an act on an innocent party, we don't intervene with whatever tool we use because we think the aggressor's life is less valuable. We aren't making a judgment that they are suddenly void of dignity. No, we believe they're still valuable individuals made in the image of God. And what we're intervening on is their behavior, not their person. And we are trying to stop them from doing something that not only would harm an innocent party, but goes against their nature, that goes against their dignity. And we don't want them to not only harm the other party, but to harm their self, to harm their soul by inflicting this act. And that the church, and I would say any civil society, would say it is a good and noble act to stop an act of aggression, but to only use the amount of force necessary to do that. And in practice, that's often the question, is how much force is needed to stop an act of aggression.
Tim, as a Catholic, you would prefer no guns at all. You would take the position that no one should have a gun.
Yes, gun. From my understanding, gun is the basic, the essential use of a gun is to kill. So nobody should have a gun.
And Tim, are you also pro-life? I mean, you support the right of a baby to be born, and you don't want the elderly committing suicide, that kind of thing.
That all seems logical. Yes.
Say so. Stephanie, I think that you addressed Tim's question. I hope that she did, Tim. But I also think, as a Catholic, his position is perfectly consistent. There's nothing the church would say that Tim needs to correct. If you want to believe that nobody should have a gun, you're welcome to believe that. Am I right or wrong?
I don't know. I would say that the call has just fascinated me, because I've never heard anyone say they don't think a police officer should have a gun. So I just find that an interesting thought to reflect upon.
Yeah.
I think we would say that people have a responsibility to protect the vulnerable.
Yeah.
And to intervene when the vulnerable are under attack. And the question is, what does that intervention look like? And yeah, maybe as you say, you don't have to use a gun.
Maybe. I mean, that's not the real world, I don't think. I mean, in the real world, police officers need guns at all, because there's guns everywhere. But, I mean, as long as a person is I'm not advocating a moral evil, he's welcome to that view.
Right.
A police officer called, but he didn't want to go on the air. I am a police officer, and it is possible to shoot someone and not kill them. Sometimes it is necessary to stop when you – okay, so fair enough. That's also true.
Which is, the gun is the tool, and it's about using the amount of force with that tool. So the force doesn't have to be shoot to kill. The force could be shoot to maim that the person can no longer continue with their course of behavior.
888-318-7884 is the number. Stephanie Gray is our guest. It is Pro-Life Month. We have celebrated just this week the 46th anniversary of the infamous Roe versus Wade decision. I want to ask you when we come back, my question to you is your level of hope currently, because I've been asking people that all week. But if you are a pro-choice person, we would love to hear from you. If you are someone who advocates for assisted suicide or euthanasia, we'd also love to have a conversation with you. You're very welcome to call 888-318-7884. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live right after this.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Now there's a fast and easy way to get in touch with EWTN, the EWTN Everything Number. Call 1-800-447-EWTN to get the latest information on programming, special events, pilgrimages, and more. Our EWTN Family Viewer Services representatives are ready to help you with whatever your needs may be. The EWTN Everything Number. 1-800-447-EWTN. EWTN.
Yes. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett. Our guest is Stephanie Gray. If you want to know more about Stephanie, if you'd like to find her writing and find about what she is up to and what Love Unleashes Life is all about, Stephanie is available, and you can find out all about her at loveunleasheslife.com. Her books are Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth, as well as A Physician's Guide to Discussing Abortion. And the communicating truth part is striking to me this week, because we have such a demonstration of absolutely almost worlds apart views regarding abortion, where we have this celebratory attitude in both the press and in the government in New York about a law to allow pretty much anybody to kill any baby as long as it hasn't been born yet. I'm exaggerating slightly, but it's not much of an exaggeration if you see what it's about. And we have also this kind of sense of hope in the pro-life movement that maybe Roe versus Wade could possibly really be overturned, not 100 years from now, but in our lifetime, if not sooner.
Mm-hmm. I think it absolutely can be. I often say that when you have great evil in your midst, it often is going to feel like it gets worse before it gets better.
Right.
And so when we see things like what happened in New York, yeah, it becomes overwhelming. And we think, oh, my gosh, how much more, you know, how much worse can it get? But there is a lot of reason for hope. You have hundreds of thousands of people gathering who are pro-life, and many more who don't come to the march but are still
right,
very much pro-life. And I think we know the end of the story. We know that Jesus is Lord. We know that God triumphs, that good is stronger than evil, and that people are changing their minds. And I think one thing that is important for us to focus on is real connection, face-to-face connection encountering people who are wounded, listening to their stories, and drawing them to a truth that will set them free. And the more we do that, the more we're going to see people be transformed and come to know Christ.
And you have hope among the young that they're getting it, that the message is getting through to young people.
They are. I just spoke at the Students for Life of America conference, almost 2,000 young people that were very much on fire by the message and wanting to share it with their friends and use
God.
The analogies and the questions that I had imparted to them. So there's definitely a lot of reason for hope.
I have noticed, too, that in much of the press that I read celebrating these events in New York, there is still the argument, the pro-choice argument seems often to rely on the idea that those who are pro-life don't like women or want to repress women. I'm not sure if you've ever heard that argument before, but how does one...
When have I not?
I don't know how... I mean, you get to the point where you... at least I do. I feel like what can get through that so that a person could at least see that... A person of goodwill might possibly believe you shouldn't kill the unborn.
Right. Well, I think we need to ask good questions like, what do you mean by that? And in what way do you think objecting to abortion is oppressing women? If I object to a woman killing her infant who's born, is that oppressing women? Okay, well then if that's not oppressing women, saying that she as a woman does not have a right to kill her born child, why is it somehow acceptable to say that she as a woman has a right to kill her preborn child? So to get them to try to explain a position that we know is indefensible. Another question I like to ask is, if you believe a woman has a right to control her own body, when does that right begin? Does it begin when the woman begins her life? And when does her life begin? To make the point that at the moment of fertilization, if you're a female, that's when that gets determined. And that there are females in the womb that are being intentionally targeted for destruction through abortion precisely because they're female. Several years ago, The Economist magazine had a headline story, 100 million missing women from the world as a result of abortion and infanticide,
oh my.
In which... 100 million. I mean, and that was a few years ago. I mean, yeah. More than that now. And to make the point that the truly pro-woman stance is one which values all human beings, including women, but men as well, by virtue of their existence, not by what they look like or how other people feel about them or whether they're XY or XX. We value the individual because the individual is human, and we acknowledge that no human has a right to end another human's life. So no woman has a right to end her child's life the way no man has a right to end his child's life.
Let's go to Wayne in Johnson City, Tennessee, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Wayne, your question for Stephanie Gray.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, Wayne. Hi.
Hi. Good evening. So I want to say outright that I do think abortion is a sin. But my position is, and I'd be very willing and open to your opinion because I'm not 100% set on this, but if we're going to discuss the matter of sin, it seems to me slightly hypocritical on the part of Catholics and the Church in general that we focus on abortion but not other extraordinarily detrimental sins like divorce, which Christ speaks of directly, or premarital sex or anything like this. It seems to me in a country in America where we're basically established as a secular nation, choosing one particular sin is kind of sort of like, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, imposing certain restrictions on women because of religious proclivities or something like that. So I struggle with this. I do think it's a sin, but I kind of sit on the fence of, well, a woman has a right to choose sin in America.
Great, great question, Wayne. And so this would be my question back. Would you agree that the Catholic Church in her teachings very clearly states that rape would be a sin?
Absolutely. No doubt about that.
And do you believe that we should have laws against rape?
No doubt about that.
So what that shows then is that we recognize that there's a position a religious institution can hold, rape is wrong, that a non-religious institution, such as a government, can also share, that we can have a different opinion on religion, the government versus the Catholic Church, but we can share an opinion on a moral issue, namely that when an innocent party is being harmed by another party, that the law of a non-religious institution should be set up so as to protect that innocent party from the aggressor. And if we hold that view as it comes to rape, then the question is, when a woman is pregnant, is there more than her body involved? And I think we know the answer is yes, because if she's not pregnant, she never goes to an abortion clinic. So the very fact that she's pregnant is a concession that within her body is another body. So therefore, if her choice to have an abortion is going to destroy the body of another party, an innocent party who cannot defend herself, who is in the only environment she should be in at that age, namely her mom's womb, if the act of abortion will destroy an innocent party, then shouldn't a non-religious institution such as a government have a law in place to protect that innocent party from abortion, the way that same institution has a law in place to protect an innocent party, such as a woman, from rape?
Now, I see that logic, but even on that position, can I make the same argument with divorce, where a man leaves his wife for another woman and devastates her completely and causes irreparable harm? So can I make the same statement that, you know, we should be advocating as the church for laws against divorce?
I think you could make the argument, but whether or not you succeed in that argument doesn't mean a more clear-cut issue like abortion, where you're dismembering the body of an innocent child, that we shouldn't have a law in that case. But I think this is why people make the argument, the institution of no-fault divorce, where someone could just, you know, get out of the marriage that they've committed to, and the person they've committed to, and the children that have resulted from that relationship, to just have a no-fault divorce, it's over, is actually a problem for the well-being of society. And there's people who make non-religious arguments in favor of upholding the commitment of marriage, or at least looking far more deeply before society would allow some type of legal acknowledgement of a separation of the union. So I think, sure, an argument could be made and people could go down that path. But even if there's debate about that issue, I would say that the topic of abortion is more analogous to the issue of rape than the issue of divorce. Not that we shouldn't consider implementing laws on that. What do you think about that, Wayne?
Wayne, go ahead.
Argument with rape. I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Wayne.
I
would have to think about the argument of whether or not it constitutes rape. I see your position, but it still seems like there's kind of a gap, because again, it comes down to what right. I do think a woman has a right to choose sin with her own body, whether it be premarital sex, whether it be using illegal drugs, whatever the case may be. And if her choice is to unfortunately violate her own body and in turn, you know, terminate the life of her child, then that's an issue. The other piece I struggle with is, even St. Paul himself said, you know, is it better to be here in the world or in heaven with Christ? So even if the woman does sin, the child is still with Christ in heaven. And I do believe that. So yes, there'll have to be a judgment for it. Yes, there'll have to be atonement for it. But at the same time, it feels hypocritical to pick on one, because obviously we're all emotionally drawn to the children, but not the other, which actually generationally could be even more detrimental, which is divorce and other like issues.
Well, and again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't go down that path and relook at the laws on divorce and what they actually say and what they should say and so forth. But when you use the example of a woman choosing to use drugs, or you use the example of a woman having sex outside of marriage, in those cases, there isn't offspring involved in those very acts that are being dismembered, decapitated, and disemboweled. When she's opting to have an abortion, it's not her body the abortion is being acted upon. It's her body that is being entered, but in order to act upon the child's body. So the question I would ask is this: what laws do we expect civil societies to have when it comes to how parents ought to treat their offspring? And so I think it would be safe to answer that by saying civil societies should have laws that require parents to care for, not harm, their offspring. So to meet their offspring's basic needs, food, clothing, shelter. And if you fail in those areas, you'll be charged with neglect. If you directly act in a negative way so as to inflict harm, not by withholding something, but by acting upon the child in a very negative way, that also should be considered unlawful. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. That makes perfect sense.
Okay, so then I would say, since science teaches us that life begins at fertilization, and therefore parenthood begins at fertilization, then wouldn't it logically follow if we have laws expecting parents to care for their born children in terms of meeting their basic needs and not inflicting harm? We should have laws requiring parents to care for their pre-born children, meeting their basic needs and not inflicting harm.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that I do believe it's a sin. I do believe, you know, fundamentally everything you're saying. But again, I'm somewhat arguing the secular case that here in America, a woman has a right to choose sin.
A right to choose sin if the sin is to take the life of another person? That's what I think Stephanie is saying.
I think there's a difference between a right to do something and an ability to do something. We all have the ability to do sin, but we don't have the right to sin. I can sin, but the question is, should I? And what ought the woman do?
Stephanie Gray, thank you so much for another very fine hour. I hope we can have you on soon.
You.
I want to do a pro-abortion people call. That's it. I want to do an hour that with you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Love Unleashes Life is the book and the website. Go to Love Unleashes Life and get to know Stephanie Gray better. You won't be sorry that you did. Thanks again, Stephanie. Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. We'll see you then, God willing.